Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. We redesigned Entree Architect Academy, our private online membership program, to better meet your needs with more options and less cost. Build a better business. Be a better architect. To learn more, visit the homepage at entrearchitect.com. This is Entree Architect Podcast, and you're listening to episode 167. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Another inspiring story this week here at Entree Architect Podcast. This one from an architect turned accidental entrepreneur. He turned an important need for managing the finances at his own small firm into a basic software tool to solve that problem. He then shared that creation with a few colleagues and then formed a small company to help sell it to others. And then eventually, he sold that small company to a large company, a large software company, where today it's offered to architects throughout the world. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, for architects, by architects, the story behind ArchiOffice with entrepreneur architect Stephen Burns. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, NCARB, BQE Software, and RCAT. FreshBooks. Get organized, save time invoicing, and get paid faster. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/freshbooks. And NCARB, helping architects reach their career goals. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/NCARB. And BQE Software, the makers of ArchiOffice, office and project management software designed specifically for architects. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/BQE. And RCAT, the leading online resource for free building product information. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/RCAT. Stephen Burns, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark R. LePage. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Stephen is an architect based in Los Angeles, California. He's the creator of ArchiOffice Project Management Software, which is a very inspiring and interesting story, which we'll definitely get into a little bit. Currently the chief creative officer of BQE Software, which is the makers of ArchiOffice. And as you've heard in the intro, and you'll hear a little bit later, BQE is our newest platform sponsor. So Stephen, thank you very much for sponsoring the show and supporting Entree Architect. I appreciate that.
Our pleasure.
Steven's been a friend for a long time here at Entree Architect. He's done quite a bit of content for us. He's written articles for the blog, and he was one of the contributors to my original Entree Architect Academy blog series back in 2013. I had just recently relaunched as EntreeArchitect.com and went from a personal blog to a platform for small firms. So I created this blog series in 2013. You can actually find it at EntreeArchitect.com/academy-blog-series. It's sort of a secret link that nobody knows about. It's all there. And he did a three-part series within that series for financial management, which is great. And then we use that information as inspiration for the course that we give away to members of Entree Architect to learn how to build better businesses and be more profitable. And that's that free course that we give away in the beginning of the podcast. Steve has also been a fellow juror on the Charette Venture Group business plan competition, which this year they're not doing. They're doing other promotional activities, but that was fun. And Steven, I can't believe that it's taken us this long, 4 years or so, to get you here on the podcast.
Yeah, well, it's last time you had maybe one more hair on your head back then.
yeah, maybe. Every day I lose a few more.
It's been a while.
Right? Yeah, but I appreciate you here. I would love to start with your personal story, your origin story. You're an architect, but you're now a chief creative officer at BQE. I'd love to know what inspired you to become an architect, what sort of got you into the profession in the first place, and then what led you into where you are today.
Yeah, I guess my entire career path has been led by a series of accidents. And, you know, what's interesting is when we talked, because I remember we were jurors on the business plan competition, there were some people who were projecting out 10 years into the future. Right. And as someone who started a number of businesses, I realized if you can go beyond 3 years, you know, it's a pipe dream, basically. So, you know, you can't project where you're going to be in the future. So I was in college studying fine art. My dream was to be a sculptor. And so I majored in sculpture at Syracuse University.
Do you still sculpt?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, so I was a senior and I had a senior show and my work was really enormous. They were basically installations, room installations. And just by accident, some woman had come up to me at the opening of my show, and I didn't know who she was, but she said, what am I doing after school? And I was half joking when I said I was going to be a waiter at Phoebe's restaurant in town, and which was kind of like the nice restaurant in town. And she said, well, you really should consider studying architecture. And I don't think it was a serious consideration of mine before that, but I thought maybe that's a good way to delay being a waiter. and maybe it would help inform my sculpture. But the ultimate dream for me was to end up, you know, on a mountain in Colorado somewhere, being not a hippie, but sort of living that simple lifestyle. And so I went off. I ended up at MIT in the graduate program for architecture, and I honestly was very unhappy there. It was a program that didn't suit me, but I went because I had been given a scholarship, and I didn't get into my first choice, which was Harvard. So I was in school, and this is actually a really good lesson, because when I applied to grad school, you have to fill out, there's a lot of essay work, right? And I was dating a girl who was an English major, and I'm not, maybe things have changed. Maybe my blogs aren't very well written, but I was a terrible writer back then. So she was taking my thoughts and writing them and editing them and re-editing them. And I went back while I was at MIT and I reread my application to grad school, and I realized that wasn't who I was. It was something completely different. And so I went up to Harvard, I got a fresh application, and these were the days where we didn't have computers, but there were typewriters. So I took the application, went to the library at MIT, and just stuck it in the typewriter and just typed straight I figured I had nothing to lose because I was already in grad school. The worst case scenario is I wouldn't get accepted. That was the only school I was applying to. And if I didn't get accepted, I'll just suffer through MIT. But I wrote from the heart, and it was filled with little typos. I used a little whiteout. I know your younger audience probably doesn't know about that. Although the whiteout pens are great for drawing, I got to tell you that much. So I ended up getting accepted. So I had to start all over again. So I took a 3.5-year program, and I turned it into a 4.5-year program. And I loved being at the Graduate School of Design. Every minute of it was fantastic. My classmates were great. The experience was great. And after that, I kind of had forgotten about sculpture. I was born again as an architect, and went off after graduation, started my career at SOM in Chicago, and I had another happy accident, I guess, because we were, I think, 1,400 people in the Chicago office at that time, so it was pretty big, and this is a great story, actually. There was a woman who sat across from me in the studio, and really what it was we were all still drafting tables, but there was one computer at the end of each of these long drafting tables. So I was just on a drafting table, and I was looking across at this woman who was also in our studio, and someone had sent her a flower arrangement for her birthday. And the flowers died, and so she took the flowers and threw them away, but there was this bowl that just sat in front of us, between the two of us. And I saw it there all morning. I decided at lunch I'm going to go out to State Street onto Woolworths and go get some goldfish and put it in there. So I go to Woolworths. I get two goldfish. I put them in a little fish bowl, and it looked so nice, and people came by and said that was kind of nice. So the next day I went back out to Woolworths, and I bought one of those, I don't know where they are, 10-gallon aquarium.
Yeah.
And got some colored sand and a diver Dan and a filter, and you know, and then I bought 13 more fish, because we had 14 partners, and I have to be honest, one of the goldfish did die the first day. So I had one goldfish. So I went out and I bought because Woolworths had this fantastic pet section on State Street. So I got all these different fish, and I put them in the tank at the office, and a sign said, please don't feed the partners. And I had been at SOM at that point for maybe 3 months. And so there were 14 fish, each representing one of the partners. Like, we had one female partner at the time, and that was the goldfish. And they all had their own kind of idiosyncratic look. And everybody started coming by. Even the partners started coming by. So within 3 months, every partner at SOM knew me. And that was kind of another happenstance. I hadn't planned on it. I was just having some fun. Anyway, Bruce Graham, who was the senior partner, kind of took an interest in me and gave me some great opportunities. But I never would have met him really otherwise, certainly not that soon. So he kind of helped me make my career pretty quickly at SOM. I had really wonderful opportunities, ended up living in London for a year, and then Berlin for just shy of 2 years. And anyway, cut that story short.
I think we may see dozens of fish tanks all across the United States and globally throughout architecture firms from now on.
That would be great for the fish and for the people doing that. Anyway, I was my wife and I were living in Berlin, Germany, working for SOM, and we were about to have our first child, and we had to make a big career decision whether I was going to stay at SOM or, you know, if I ever had the hopes of opening my own office, would we do it? And I figured it's probably easier to do it before I have real, you know, children and that kind of responsibility, so let's go do that. So we moved back to Chicago. I put in my resignation and opened an office just by myself, without really any foresight or planning, and no business plan, nothing written. Yeah. You know, everything against the rules that Mark R. LePage says one really needs to do to have a successful business.
How old were you when you did that?
This would be 1993, 35.
Okay.
No, 37.
Yeah.
37. I was born in 58. I can't do the math. So anyway, that was 1993. So I was alone for a month. I had one project, you know, simple residential project, and I was alone for a month, and I realized I'm really not good alone. I like being in a team of people, and I kind of missed that. So I called on a friend of mine who worked at a mid-sized firm in Chicago, and he had been there for 9 years. And I asked him, you know, what his plans were for the future, and would he be interested in joining me as a partner? So we had a big long lunch, talked about it. He talked to his wife, and who was also an architect at SOM. That's how I knew him. And he said, yeah, let's do it. So we formalized a business, a partnership. You know, I had a lawyer, and we drew up a partnership agreement, and became an S Corp, actually, and opened an office, and just the two of us. And so we were very frugal, and we found a great little space for very little money in downtown Chicago, and built it out, you know, by ourselves, built our own furniture and that kind of stuff. Then we hired a guy. That was the really biggest decision we had ever made at that point. Yeah. Bigger than signing a lease is now we realize we're responsible to feed this person.
That first employee, I think, is maybe one of the toughest decisions every small firm architect has to make.
Yeah, is that right? Yeah. Yeah, you're really responsible at that point. But prior to that is, you know, you took draws, you know, from the business to pay yourself when you could. But now you have to really make sure you make enough money month by month to not just pay those small bills that we had at the time, but pay this guy. And because he committed to us, he left a job to be with us. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So but I guess once you break the ice, then each time after that, it gets
exactly
a little bit
easier, right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so eventually we then hired two people. But in the long run, I sold the firm in 2007. So I was there for 14 years. We had 17 architects when I sold it. So we were still a small firm, but family.
Were you still partners at that time?
Yeah, we were. Yeah. Gary and I were still the founding partners. Those two original employees that I talked about, they each owned 8% of the business, which we were compelled to do within a few years because we needed to retain them. They were important, and which was also an interesting lesson is we didn't think they had the chops to be partner material. They were great at their jobs, but you know, we were bringing in the business and we were the front facing people of the firm. But what I learned was, you know, the minute you bring them into the club, they grew up really quickly.
Yeah.
They, you know, on one hand, it proved to their own families and that they are a partner in a firm, and then they acted very differently. They rose to the occasion really well. I was very proud of the two of them.
So that was a good decision to make those two people partners.
It was.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was. You know, for us financially, you know, we had to make a good deal to them to make them able to afford into the partnership, and there was never any resentment on our part, but I think everybody ended up being happy, although I think they would have wished to have more equal partnership. Mm-hmm. As time grew on. What ended up happening is I ended up selling each of them. They bought each of them bought out my halves of the business when I decided I wanted to leave and pursue a career in software. But I think it's just a good lesson is, you know, if you pick the right people, it's like the right partner in life. You know, you pick the right person, your life is enriched. And you let them do what they do well and give them enough room to grow. And, you know, we made them partners when we needed to and they wanted it. And it worked out well.
Did you feel that those two people were the right people at the time? Or were you making that decision out of fear of losing them and it just worked out?
For one of them, I didn't want to lose him. He was he had a skill set that would have been missed very much. The other one... she was very talented and capable, and I thought she probably would open her own office. And I thought it would be it's oftentimes great to sort of inherit an office, right? Somebody's already got systems in place. And actually, this is another thing, is when we hired her, she was our she was number three in the company at that point. We had three people. She was the number fourth, the fourth person in the company. And she looked around and she was like, this is the worst materials library I've ever seen. There's no product literature here. I mean, we had like a 2 feet of shelf space, right? And the next thing we knew, she never even asked for permission. She was just calling in vendors and product literature, and we had to build a whole room just for all the supplies and materials she was bringing in. So it really demonstrated that this person had the gumption to, you know, to take on things and do things the way she wanted to. So I was always not concerned about her, but the real surprise was the other guy who ended up being a wonderful partner, and a different type of partner. You know, that's another thing, is your partners should not be you. They should be to fill in the spaces that you are.
Right. Yeah. You should know your strengths and hire your weaknesses.
Exactly. Right.
Would you have done it the same way today if you knowing what you know now and knowing what had happened with the firm, would you have still made those decisions?
I would like to say I am wiser today, and before I had done anything, I would have at least written an executive summary type business plan about why I am doing this and what I'm hoping to achieve with this business and, you know, where I'd like to go with it, as opposed to just having it tucked away somewhere in the back of my mind. But I also know me, and I am, I'm more spontaneous. So I'm actually working on some things right now, and
you haven't changed.
I'm falling into that same trap, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it works. You know, so
doesn't always, right?
Yeah. So go on. I wanted to, because I think hiring those first people and then making the decision to make those people partners, those are huge decisions early on in your career, because especially when they become partners, that's a long-term commitment on both parts. And so I think making that first decision to hire somebody is one thing. But then to take on partners and having to go through all of that negotiation and how much do you give and how little do you give and all of the emotional pieces that go along with all that, that's a very big decision that a lot of architects are very afraid of doing. You know, sole practitioners are afraid of doing that, and maybe, you know, partners that are two partners like you had, taking on additional partners, there's a lot of fear in that.
Yeah, I can understand that. We didn't want to lose control, so we made sure that the founding partners, we both retained control, but we gave them enough that it wasn't insignificant, but enough to make them feel they were owners of a company and they would get a reasonable dividend, each year for that investment. But you know, ultimately, the two of us still controlled the decisions that were being made. But there is something to be said to making people feel ownership in something. That a paycheck is nice, and you can compensate them highly if you're capable of doing that. But their affiliation or their commitment to you in the long term is much more fragile if they don't have ownership. Yeah, you know, I guess it's like this, you know, this golden handcuff or whatever they refer to that as.
Well, you had mentioned that one of the first things you said is that their whole personality changed, the way they looked at their job and the firm was a completely different perspective from their point of view and from your point of view.
They started dressing differently.
Yeah. So there's lots of advantages to making that decision if you find the right person. You know, pulling the trigger on something like that with the wrong person could be disastrous.
Oh, well, obviously, that's always going to be the case in life, right?
Yeah.
Picking the right people. I've been very fortunate, with my wife, it was a perfect pick. With my partner, it was perfect. And our partners after that, it was perfect. I also have a very strong feeling about people who you pick who you know aren't right, because I've had that where we've hired some people in our office. Over the years, we probably hired some 40 people. And some stick and some don't stick. But here's a lesson I learned, which is the moment you get a feeling that somebody's not right, either the skill isn't right or they don't fit in the culture that you're trying to maintain or create, you need to let that person go. It's often, for small firms especially, it's hard to because you've got deadlines and there's not enough, you know, whatever, and you feel like if that person's gone, then I got to do it myself, or we're going to, or we have to find somebody and get them up to speed. And that's a lot of effort. And so they really delay getting rid of the bad apple. But because we've had a number of bad apples that we brought in over the years to work at the company, one thing that was consistent is the minute you did finally let them go, everything got better.
On both sides.
Well, I didn't keep up with them
I've seen that happen in my own firm, and I've heard that with others, is that very often that situation where it's just not the right fit and there's a struggle happening, that not only is there's a weight lifted from your shoulders as the employer, but even the person that you let go realizes that that wasn't really a good fit, and they go move on to, and find the place where their strengths really do thrive.
Sure. I would hope that would be the case. Honestly, I just haven't followed with those people, but you know, it's eventually like any breakup. You hope that people move on to something that's a better suited for them. But I do know from staying within our firm that the people had like a big sigh of relief that that person was gone. They all knew it was not a good thing. And so why wait 6 months or a year to do that? Do it and get the pain over with and get on with it.
Now, very often in small firms, not only in addition to all the things that you said that make it difficult, but those people become friends. You know, that they, in, when you only have a few people in the firm, you start building personal relationships with a lot of these people. And it makes it even harder, because it's hard to fire a friend or disappoint somebody that you're personally connected with.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, FreshBooks, NCARB, and BQE Software. You already know all about RCAT and their free BIM objects and their CAD details and their specifications and product information, all free, ready for you to use. Well, today I want to share something new from RCAT. It's called Charette. Charette is a tool for sharing and collaborating with your colleagues and clients online in real time. You can upload photos and files, share specs and product information directly from the RCAT database, as well as from other sources on the internet. I've been playing with Charette in beta for a while now, and it's really cool. And now it's available to you. I encourage you to go check it out. Visit RCAT online and click the Charette icon right there on the homepage. And like everything offered at RCAT, Charette is a free tool for us small firm architects too. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/RCAT. 192 hours. You wish you had that much free time? That works out to about 2 business days every month. And when you're a small firm architect using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, that's the amount of administration time that you could save in 2017. That's time that you can spend doing the things you love, like being an architect. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Do you know someone in your firm who's always dreamed of getting licensed, but was unable to complete the experience requirements? Well, maybe that person's you. Now you can get back on track with NCARB's new AXP portfolio. With this option, seasoned professionals can complete the Architectural Experience Program, the AXP, formerly known as the IDP, by submitting an online portfolio. Along with meeting your state's education and examination requirements, the portfolio will help you and your employees get one step closer to becoming a licensed architect. Learn more about NCARB's AXP portfolio at entrearchitect.com/NCARB. One of the most often requested resources here at Entree Architect is project management software. How do we keep our projects and our people organized while we grow as entrepreneur architects? BQE Software, an AIA Advantage partner and the makers of ArchiOffice, will show us how. ArchiOffice is the only office and project management software designed specifically for architects. It will help us manage people and projects and allow us to focus on designing great architecture. Whether you're working remotely or on site, ArchiOffice allows you to monitor the status of your projects and tasks and send out invoices in an accurate and timely manner. Entree Architect podcast listeners can get a fully functional 15-day trial of ArchiOffice today at entrearchitect.com/BQE. RCAT, FreshBooks, NCARB, and BQE Software, please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So you decided to sell, and you sell out to your partners. And so what's the next step from there? Where did you go? And why did you do that? Why did you decide
Yeah, so that's the backstory to ArchiOffice, our business software. So I opened the office in 1993, and in about 1995, we had about 5 employees then, and I was not happy running a business. I was finding that owning a business was taking me away from doing what I loved, what I did best. And, you know, I'm a designer at heart, and so I realized that all the time I was spent running the business could be done better. I just needed to design a better system to do that. So it was, not something I wrote down. I said, well, I'm going to design software to run my business. I didn't know the first thing about software.
Yeah.
But I started to, I bought FileMaker Pro, which was a Mac-based at the time. I think actually it was cross-platform, but it was owned by Apple, quietly owned by Apple. And I was a Mac guy, and so it was a very easy-to-use scripting language to build, you know, simple solutions to solve some problems rather than like using Excel spreadsheets. So I got hooked on that. And I would set a task to take care of, and I'd go home at the end of the day, and I would work, and Mark, literally for 3 years till 3 or 4 every morning, I worked 365 days a year. It was an addiction.
Yeah, passion.
It was a passion, right? It was, but my wife called it an addiction.
There's a fine line.
I suppose. Maybe addictions are not healthy. Passions are, supposedly. But yeah, every day I would go home and I would, you know, have these new things to build, and I'd bring them into the office the next day, and people would say, that's great. Can you make it do this? And then I'd go home and I would do that over and over and over again. So at the end of 3 years, we had the system in my office, which we called ArchiOffice Pro, only because it ran under FileMaker Pro, right? And it was running everything in the office, much more than what the commercial version of ArchiOffice does today. It was phenomenal. And we had, and so this is now 3 years later, so we had about 14 employees. And I remember the newest employee called his old boss, who he said, he told him, you know, hey, you were always looking for something to manage your office, some software. These guys use this stuff. It does everything. So his old boss called me up, introduced himself to me, and he wanted to know about it. So I had him come down to our office, and he was actually a competitor of ours. When we would go out interviewing for jobs, which was the high-end single-family residential market in the North Shore of Chicago predominantly, or downtown Chicago as well, Chicago. So we would invariably go up against him. But, you know, it's like a baby or a building. You're so proud of it, you want to show it to anybody, right? So he came in and he looked at what we were doing and he was like, can I buy this? And that's the first moment that light bulb clicked in my, that, oh, right, this might be of value to somebody else. It was not, it was really for me. So I said, give me 3 months, let me clean it up and let's put it in your office and see what happens. So I kind of stripped out all of our own data from in it. I kind of gave him a nice virgin database, brought it into his office, trained him on it, and let him go for a year. And at the end of that year, we said we would get together and kind of assess how things were going.
So you get, did you give it to him for free?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It was all put in there
for
free.
And cleaned it up and gave it to him sort of as a beta, see how it works.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. You know, I would go up to his office, you know, every so often and work with them. But at the end of the year, he said, hey, can I invest in this and can we make this a commercial product? And so that was the moment really when I got my life back, because if it's going to be a commercial product, yeah, I'm not going to be the developer of it. It has to meet a higher standard. I'm not educated as formally as a software programmer. So we put our monies together and hired a real development team. I ended up finding a team in Melbourne, Australia. And I did that purposely because they came to work at about 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon Chicago time. So I could run the business normally, you know, be an architect, play architect by day and play software developer by night.
Right.
So, you know, I would meet with those guys, you know, 3 to 4 days a week in the afternoons, late afternoons or early evenings, review the progress. But after a couple of years, they had the version ready. Basically, it cost me twice as much money and took twice as long as which I was told is absolutely standard in software development, at least at the time. So, but I said, no, these guys are great. They can do it on budget and on time. That's what they tell me. But it took twice as much time and twice as much money. But we made it a commercial product in April of 2004. And that was the year that the AIA had the convention in Chicago, which was our backyard. And I, you know, spent money to take a booth. You know, it was a big commitment for us at the time because we really had no revenue, and launched ArchiOffice there. So by December of 2006, we had 500 firms using it already, and it was serious. So
how did you get the word out? How did you market it? Because it wasn't all from the convention, right?
Well, the convention was really great because there wasn't a lot of technology going on back then in the space, and there was a lot of activity. I think the way the AIA ran the national convention back in those days, there was a lot more time for people to be in the expo. Today, it's a little more difficult, but there was that. Then there was a forum called Architosh, I believe that's what it was called. So it was an architect's Macintosh user forum.
Yeah, I think that still exists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they got the word about us even before we launched. I kind of put the website up and somehow they came across it and they started promoting us a little bit. So we got some exposure that way.
Yeah.
But it was really word of mouth between them, and we didn't have money for real marketing. We did the trade show. After that, I would do small advertising in the AIA local publications in Chicago. You know, used to take out like a little eighth of a page ad, which grew to a quarter page ad, to a half page ad, to eventually full page ads.
Right.
That was the days when they would send it as a printed magazine and to all the membership.
And you said you had about 500 subscribers or purchasers?
Yes. Yeah, so, back in those days, it was a purchase. You purchased the license, and by the end of 2006, we had over 500 firms. And you realize, like, hiring that first employee, you're really responsible because these people, they're running their businesses, you know, on your platform. So what I did is I hired a management consultancy to look at this business and make a recommendation. My expectation was that they were going to suggest, why don't we bring in a CEO? Why don't we just sell this and let somebody take it somewhere? Because I love being an architect. I love my firm and all. But they spent 3 months, they talked to a lot of our customers, they looked at the marketplace, and they actually made a recommendation which I didn't expect. No different than that woman, you know, told me go study architecture.
Right.
You know, they said, you know, we think this is a great opportunity for you to move full-time into software development.
You're like, whoa, that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted you to take this off my hands so I can go back to being an architect.
Yeah. So I was stunned by that. But I was also, I think it was approaching 50. So I like thinking of my life as chapters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had my own firm for 14 years. I was at SOM for 7 years. And, you know, I thought, well, I was an architect in Chicago, which is a pretty conservative certainly in the residential market, which is really where we focused. We were high-end single-family residential, some restaurants, boutique hotels, but mostly that kind of project, those types of projects. We're not in a flat environment like Chicago, weren't that challenging. The clients, the programs, everything was pretty much, it was almost like Groundhog Day.
Yeah,
you know?
Yep.
Just
designing the names same project over and over again.
The names are different, but the projects are pretty much similar. And so I thought, wow, that's different. So my wife and I talked about it, and we said, yeah, let's go do this. So first we talked about, okay, do we take sort of a sabbatical? You know, do you take a leave of absence from the architecture firm, or maybe put 5% of your time in the architecture firm and 95% of your time into the software? But I, as I mentioned, I kind of just rush into things without much thought. And I said, no, if you're going to make this successful, you have to go into it 100%. You got to close the door here. I don't want to have a safety net. I don't want to have a back door that I can escape to if things get tough, right?
So you jumped off the cliff.
So
no turning back.
Pardon me?
No turning back when you jump off the cliff.
No turning back. Right, no turning back. So that was also, by the way, you talked about earlier about bringing in partners. This was now the next big thing was, well, if I'm going to sell my portion of the firm, you know, it's the valuation of this firm right now. Now, we had a lot of this mapped out in our buy-sell agreements that we had worked with when we created this company. You know, but they talk about three different methods of valuation. And of course, it costs money to, you know, get people to value your company. And so we went through this process. Then we kind of, the partnership, we all discussed it, kind of get a little bit heated at times. Wasn't always a friendly discussion, but we were all good friends and we worked our way through it.
What was the basis of the evaluation?
Well, some valuations brought us much higher valuations. Yeah. Others were, you know, it wasn't like they were all within 5% of each other, right? They were significant. So in the end, we just said, you know, why don't we just take the three of them and average it, right? And just end up that way.
Yeah.
So we have said that will be the way we'll do it. And that's how we ended up coming up with what it would cost them to buy me out. And that was great. I had a great goodbye party. And then the next day I started at work in my new office as a software developer. So, you know, we go from an office of, you know, 17 architects, a couple of staff, you know, just under 20 people to what was four of us. Okay. So,
And was your original partner in ArchiOffice, the other architect who invested in it, was he still part of it?
He was absolutely still part of that, as was my original business partner at my architectural firm, Burns & Merrill Architects. So, you know, Gary Merrill was still a part. He was still an owner in the software business, and he was an owner in that business, but I was no longer an owner in his business. But I had a salesperson, a marketing person, and like we call it a COO, who took care of it. And then I really worked with the development team in Australia, in Melbourne, and kind of, I guess I was CEO, but that's a highfalutin term for a four-person company.
Yeah.
Right. So think about it. This was 2007 that we did this. So in, I think it was June of 2007, I left my architectural firm, took all of my money from that sale, and put it straight into a software business. So what's coming around the corner?
The end of the world.
The end of the world came.
Yeah, that day.
Yeah. So what we had was we decided with the advice of the management consultants, if we're going to move this to a real next generation thing, we have to leave FileMaker. You know, it's a great solution for people to build their own, but as a independent software vendor, it's not a great platform because, you know, you're constantly updating your software and distributing those updates was very difficult. So we had done some research into what was the next platform and made that decision and that commitment. And it was an extremely expensive investment. So, that's what we did. And that was all that money was being invested at the same time that the economy was crumbling. And next thing I knew is architects weren't buying software. They were laying off staff. Yeah. Or if they owned, you know, our software and they had like 8 seats of it, now they needed to only renew 3 seats next year. So a lot of the recurring revenue was dropping off. So we were really kind of hemorrhaging. I got to be honest with you, Mark. It was the most stressful time in my life.
Yeah, I can imagine.
you know, thinking I should have left that back door in place, right? And the architecture firm, which, you know, I'm still close to my old partners. I'm their landlord, frankly. So you know, we're very close. They went down to about 12 architects, so it didn't get that bad, because, you know, frankly, single family residential, to somebody, always getting rich in a bad economy,
right? And they're going to high end. It slowed down, but it didn't stop.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but it was very, very stressful. We were very close to shutting down the company.
And what year was that decision?
2009. Okay, so we were preparing to really close the company in 2009. My wife and I said, we're not going to pour any more money into this. So the management consultants were basically working with me on how do you shut down an enterprise like this? You know, we were going to release the code to all of the users and say, you know, good luck with it, right? You can use it, you know, forever. It's yours.
And you had fully developed it and relaunched it and... Right. So you had a
full, So they
were still in development.
They were still using the FileMaker Pro solution. We were probably still a year away from the new platform, the next, you know, platform.
Which made that even worse.
Yeah. So all that money would have been just thrown away entirely. But so it was April or May of 2009. That was the year. Became a fellow at the College of Fellows of the AIA. And so when you go to the convention, which I always did the conventions for every year, you know, I'm always at the booth. You have, you know, you're on the floor 3 days straight talking nonstop. But that year, because of the commitments you have in the fellowship thing, I was away from the booth a lot. And I was going to go out with a bang. So we had actually purchased three booth slots. You know, we had... a 30-foot booth, and it was my last gasp. See what we could do with this. We had actually brought in the Volkswagen Bug with the jet engine in it. You know that story at all? You know,
no.
I saw on David Letterman there was this Volkswagen Beetle. This guy put a jet engine, a helicopter jet engine, in the back of that thing, and he took it out to a runway somewhere in California with David Letterman, and they ran this thing. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
So. I called the guy up. I found out who he was online, and I said, "Hey, I love the idea of a Volkswagen Bug, because it's the simplest thing. Everybody can drive a Volkswagen Bug, but it had the power of a jet, and that's the way I used to talk about ArchiOffice. I said, it's really simple to use, but it's really powerful. So, can I rent it from you and put it in our booth?" And he's like, "Yeah, why not?" And I said, "And remember, by the way, I'm a poor architect." And he says, "Well, I'm from San Francisco, and here you're referred to as a software business." And actually what he ended up doing was he said, "You can have the car for free. Just let me hang out at your booth so I could talk to people about it and give me any of the swag that you guys give out." Right?
Not a bad deal.
So we had this fantastic Bug, and everybody came by the booth to see this this thing. We sent out some promotional stuff to tell people there was this cool car in our booth. But I wasn't there. I was, you know, half the time I was away. So it turned out that the CEO of one of our competitors had been coming by and wanting to meet with me, and I was not available. And I didn't get to talk to him until after I returned to Chicago. And so that would be Shafat Kazi, who's the CEO here of BQE Software. And so then that was another accidental thing, because
he was an architect as well.
No, Shavat was originally a structural engineer. Okay.
But
I think actually this is the joke I have, is it finally it gave him the opportunity to have a structural engineer own an architect, right? Instead of working under an architect. But so I called Shavat back when I got to Chicago, and before I called him, I actually called the management consultants. I said, "This guy who owns one of our competitors' products is wanting to talk to me. What do you think that is?" And they said, "Well, that's good news, because they knew where we were going with our business." And they said, "Well, just call them up and have what they call the happy talk, which is just like what we're having. You know, let's just have a nice conversation."
Right.
And that's where he asked me about what we're doing and my story, and I got to hear about his story and, you know, where he was going with, you know, his company. And at the end of that, he asked if we can sign an NDA, you know, a non-disclosure agreement, and talk a little bit more. So we did that, and I also asked the consultants to be a part of that conversation. And that's really where they wanted to dig a little deeper into what we're doing.
And that happened at that convention where you get, you know, you gave everything in, three booths, you were going to decide to close it up, and this man calls.
Well, yeah, I didn't think this was going to happen. I was really thinking that we would get a lot more traction and more people would be interested.
Right,
and
you're trying to sell more product.
Sell more product, you know, in spite of a declining economy, I was, you know, going to go out with a bang. That's the way we do things, right? So we basically talked a lot more about what we thought about the business. We did not really share with them what our ultimately we were going to running out of time here. So about a few days later, he came back and he said, I'd like to acquire the company, is really what it was. Up until that, by the way, Mark, you know, my life was sheer hell, to be honest with you. It is so sad and tragic to have to shut down a business that you've invested a fortune in, right? And start all over again. It's from an ego standpoint, that's one thing, but I also had, at that point, we had seven guys that were working for our company, and those were, again, people that earned their livelihood through us. And then letting down our customers was probably the worst of it all, you know? So anyway, that deal happened. In December of 2009, BQEA Software acquired Archie Office and Engineer Office, and, you know, all of our assets and stuff. And I became an employee at BQE Software. And so that's what brought me here to California, left Chicago.
Ah, there you go. There you go. Because I was waiting for that part of the story. Because you've been in Chicago all along.
So for a very long time, as we were trying to wrap up these negotiations about the acquisition and everything, we were going to basically be a new office for BQE in Chicago. Because BQE Software has a lot of customers across the country. A lot are on the East Coast, just from the sheer numbers of architects and engineers and, you know, business professionals. And so supporting them on the East Coast from a West Coast time difference was a little more difficult. So they said, hey, if we're in the Midwest, we're going to be good, so we can move more of our support department into the Chicago area. But it wasn't until about a month before the closing that they, Shafat said, we want you in LA.
So was that another big decision you had to make? I mean, your whole life was there.
Yeah, my wife and I lived when we left to go full time into software, we said, wow, we can live anywhere. As an architect, you have your network, your community, and this was certainly with the kind of work I was doing. So you don't want to leave where you are. But when it was software, my wife and I said, well, we could move. Where should we move? So we started looking around. We were looking at Seattle and Portland and North Carolina and Boulder. But we looked at San Francisco, but we never looked at LA. It was like not on the top 20 list. Who wants to be in LA? La La Land, right? So it turned out where we were living after we did all this investigation, and there's some websites where you could compare, you know, cost of living and quality of life and schools and all those things. And we had two young children, and it says, we should just stay where we are. It's, you know, raise the family here. It's the best place. How are we on time, by the way?
We're good. We're good.
Okay. So he said, we'd like you to be here in LA. It's important that you be here. So I mentioned that to my wife, and that was the year of the worst winter that Chicago had at that point. And I was traveling a lot, and she was using the snowplow. We had a very long driveway, and she didn't even take a half a breath. She said, sure. So
done, sold.
Right, yeah. You know, my daughter was going to enter ninth grade. That's a good transition period. Unfortunately for my son, who was entering 11th grade, he would have been, you know, so they stayed in Chicago till the end of the school year, and then they all moved out in June of 2010. And we did the move. But that, yeah, you're right. But again, nothing planned about that. That just was, we think we need to be here in LA.
So where are you now? You moved there in 2010.
Right. So we
last we, 7 years.
We moved to a little beach town called Redondo Beach, which was great. We found a mid-century modern house, which was difficult to find. California, this part has horrible, I think because you live in such a great climate and the views are so beautiful, they just build garbage. People will pay anything for junk. So, but we did find a mid-century modern house, and we leased it for a couple of years while we tried to figure out where to live, because it's really huge, L.A. We live today in an area called Playa Vista, which is where Howard Hughes's airfield used to be, right near the Spruce Goose airplane hangar. It's completely redeveloped, sort of new urbanism. And now that we're empty nesters, where it's a bit more urban experience for us. But I love L.A. now. But it's funny how it wasn't even on our radar.
And so what's the future look like? Where you obviously you moved to creative director 3 years ago, 2014?
Yeah, I started as, I don't believe in titles, but yeah. I guess you need a title. It's really meaningless. What I actually do here, I do a lot of things. I kind of dabble in a lot of things. I think that's one of the great things about architects is I think from our training and our ability to look at lots of things and bring them together, that's kind of what my role is here. So one of the things that we knew we wanted to do was really do best of breed of both of our products. So BQE Software had a flagship product called BuildQuick that is now in its 22nd year. And ArchiOffice is now in its 13th year. But they are quite different. And what we said is, let's get the best of breed from both of those and build something. So I can't tell you too much about what's going on here, but there's a big announcement that's coming down the pike. We're in a beta program right now with a good number of our customers of something really phenomenally new and exciting, which I'm not allowed to talk about, but it's really the whole reason this even happened. It's now 7 years since I joined the company, and it's taken that long to get us to this. But we, so basically for the past 3 years, we've been working on something really new.
Well, that's exciting. When you're ready to announce it to small firms, let me know.
Yeah, you'll be the first to know.
Because I'd love to have you come back and talk about it here and sort of not only announce it, but talk about the story and the rest of the story. So it's it would be very, very, very interesting. That's a great story. I find architect stories so interesting, and someone who went from an architecture office to building software, always and still an architect, fully, you're still I still consider you an architect.
I call it a recovering architect.
Yeah. Yeah, I think once you're an architect, you're always an architect, and you don't have to design buildings to be an architect. But very inspiring story. I appreciate you for sharing your story here today.
Well, my pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you about it.
Good.
I hope the listeners didn't mind it. But
no, yeah. I think most of us know who ArchiOffice is. They certainly do now that you're a sponsor. It's very interesting to me because I didn't know that story. It's very interesting for me to learn the story, of how it happened. I think it's inspiring for those architects who have similar ideas. Mm-hmm. I have this idea that I can solve this problem, and maybe it's software, maybe it's a physical product. How do I do that? Should I do that? Should I overcome the fear of doing that? Lots and lots of lessons in that story. So I appreciate you for being honest and open about it.
Yeah, I for years I didn't talk about the hardships. I've come, as it's gotten farther away, to be able to, because I think it's important that people know that it's not always, a rosy, experience. There are going to be these difficult times. But I also think that people look at businesses sometimes as a business opportunity. They look out there and they say, there's an opportunity, I'll fill it. But I think as architects, I think we're uniquely skilled at certain things. And it is, for me, I have a problem. Can I solve my problem? And then you'll find out that there's other people who have that very same problem. Your problem isn't really unique. And right now I'm working on a project as well for a particular problem I have that's actually not even related to architecture. But I was working on it and I happened to share it with one of our software developers here who bought into it instantly, and he could see, oh my God, you know? And so it's, I'm not trying to see a problem out there. I see a problem that I need help with.
Yeah. That's a great lesson. And I'm looking forward to hearing that story as well.
Yeah, hopefully. I don't think it'll be interesting to your listeners, though. It's not an architectural thing.
Oh, I don't know. I think there are a lot of certainly would be interesting to me, and I think there are a lot of listeners who want to hear the other side of who architects are.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just started a new series called The Entrepreneur Architect, and it's about interviewing architects and asking them the same questions every. Architect that we have on that series, we ask that same series of questions, and many of them have very, very unique stories that are very different and not related to architecture that we're learning. So it's great.
There's so many more opportunities today for people to do things outside the traditional practice of architecture. Yeah. It is because the education really stresses design and, you know, the traditional architect role. It's hard for a lot of them to leave and then think that they can be successful outside of that traditional practice, but kudos to those people who can make that break.
Yeah. The website is bqe.com. Facebook, you're facebook.com/bqesoftware. And you're active on Twitter as Stephen Burns. Before I wrap up, Stephen, I'm going to surprise you. I keep surprising my guests with this question, and I should prepare you. It's easy. Don't worry. I'm going to ask you a question. It's what's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow? And I know that it's going to be an easy one for you, but the intent is something that they can execute relatively simply and see a short-term result.
Wow. That's not as easy as you think. So you're telling me when you ask people this question, they go, oh, I know the answer.
Well,
to that.
I usually prepare people, so I'm springing.
Oh,
so well, I apologize
that you didn't decide to give me that, but that I guess that's okay. Because I can't presume what any individual firm has on their where they want to go with their firm, because you know some firms, you know, they're interested in, you know, environmental issues, other, you know. So what I actually would say is because I've been a prisoner of this before, and it prevents you from really doing things that you should be doing, which is stop with your email, okay? Don't open your email until maybe, you know, 2 p.m. Because if your morning starts by looking at your email, you've lost control of what you wanted to do. Like if you go to bed at night and say, you know, tomorrow morning I'm going to be, you know, here's my checklist of things I want to take care of. But you open up your mail, you're going to have to put out some fires that you hadn't anticipated. And all of those things that you want to do keep being put on the checklist for tomorrow or the day after, and they get pushed off. You're letting other people control your life. And the beauty of email is really, if there isn't beauty, is the asynchronous kind of communication. So it would be stop listening to things that take you away from what you were going to do, whether it is, more education in a certain area that you think you need to grow your business in, or whatever that business opportunity is. I don't want to even presume. I can guess what that business opportunity is. But the thing that impedes that from happening is something that I think we've become pretty much addicted to.
Yeah, that's a great answer. that's something no one has answered before, and I think it's a fabulous suggestion.
I could. How about eat more kale?
or eat more kale.
Both of those are good.
Pick one, right? Stephen, thank you very much for sharing your story and your knowledge here today on Entree Architect Podcast.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark, for the opportunity. I guess I'll see you in a couple weeks in Orlando.
If you liked what we shared here today, complete show notes and a direct link to download this very special, unique, one-of-a-kind episode of Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. You can find that at entrearchitect.com/episode167. Hey, you know what? Take that link right now, entrearchitect.com/episode167. Type that right into your email right now and share that link with somebody that you think might benefit from the knowledge that we share here today. The inspiration and the story and everything that we share here every week. I want at least one person that you know who doesn't know about Entrepreneur Architect and Entree Architect and EntreeArchitect.com and the Entree Architect podcast and the Entree Architect newsletter and the blog. Somebody out there that you know doesn't know we exist. So take that podcast episode, EntreeArchitect.com/episode167, and go share it with somebody that you think might benefit from what we're doing here at Entree Architect. Hey, and then don't forget to visit the website to learn more about Entree Architect Academy, our private online membership program that's built for you, the small firm entrepreneur architect. Visit the homepage today at EntreeArchitect.com. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.